What next for economics and policy in the age of Trump? That question leads to so many others. Fortunately, here on the phone is Professor Chad Bowne, editor of an ebook on that very subject. Chad Bowne is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and previously served on the Council of Economic Advisers under the Obama administration. Professor Bowne, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thanks for having me.
Economics and policy in the age of Trump. There's lots of ways you could go with that. What was your sort of focus with the book?
I guess the reason why I did this is because I thought it would be important for active researchers, economists out there, for their voices to be heard in the public policy debates around a lot of the key plans that the Trump administration is putting forward. And this administration is by now really well known, is extraordinarily different from anything we've seen in a long time in the United States. And this includes, you know, their real potential disdain for economic analysis and evidence-based policymaking. They've demoted the position of the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, so it's no longer a cabinet-level position. They've really dragged their feet on naming a chair and appointing the members to CEA. There have been some threats potentially to data collection exercises undertaken by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and other government agencies. And all of this is just really not good for facts-based, evidence-based policymaking that economists historically have been useful contributors to. So since this administration didn't really seem inclined to ask economists for input, I thought it would be important for economists to be given another venue, say, to provide that input. And so that's what really this volume is all about.
And so your intended audience then would be policymakers, people trying to just make sense of the Trump administration?
That's right. And so I think our intended audience for this book is the general public, policymakers certainly trying to provide the insights of economics, economic research, economic analysis in a way that can actually contribute to the policies that are currently being debated and potentially changed or reformed under this administration.
Coming to the book itself then, it's broken down into sections. Could you give us an overview of why you've looked at these points in this way?
The book is split into three sections. The first two are more on the domestic side of the economy. The first one in particular looks at what I call maybe the people side of the economy. So it focuses on the social safety net, labor markets, healthcare, immigration, the environment, education, those types of issues. The second set of domestic policy reforms are more to do with the macro side of the economy, tax reform, financial sector reform, the Great Recession, Dodd-Frank, the issues associated with central bank independence and the Federal Reserve and whether that's going to be challenged under this administration. And then issues of economic growth and the macroeconomy more general. And then thirdly, the last section is perhaps where the president has focused much more of his rhetoric, which is against international trade. And so it's focused on U.S. trade policy, international trade agreements, the role of the United States in the world and in supporting a rules-based trading system. And so that's really how we've organized the book.
Let's perhaps take those sections and to draw out some of the key insights then. Trump's proposed a very mixed bag of social policies, reversing Obamacare, bringing back manufacturing jobs to the U.S. What's going on there? What's the reasoning behind this? Do you think it's going to work? And what do you think is actually going to happen to many of the working class Americans who actually voted for Trump?
That's a really important point, right? And so if we think back to, you know, one of the opening lines of President Trump's inaugural address, you know, he led with the statement that, quote, the forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer, right? So it came in with a very eclectic set of voters and supporters who thought that they were getting a very different kind of U.S. president. And they are, certainly. But many of the policies that he has taken up, you know, right from the very beginning, have the potential to really worsen the lives of many of those forgotten people. And so, you know, the very first topic on the list is work on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare and the concern that potentially simply repealing that piece of U.S. legislation could throw tens of millions of people out of the insured healthcare market and what the implications would be for that. We also have contributions that look at broader issues of concern in the U.S. labor market, especially manufacturing job loss in the United States and concerns with the inadequate social safety net of the United States. In recent days, we have seen more information from the the president's proposed budget on what cuts to U.S. social safety net programs would be. These are all concerns because they essentially are addressing problems of growing U.S. inequality, the concerns over the failure of intergenerational mobility. So, you know, the inability of children to do better than their parents or to achieve what has been long known as the American dream. You know, there's many, many such concerns. And what's, I think, a nice contribution of some of the work in this volume is to really explain clearly to the public what the implications of proposed budget cuts would likely lead to.
Coming to this American dream, then, you mentioned in the book that you think the American dream is increasingly under threat. Could you tell us a bit more what you mean by that?
Well, I think the economist Melissa Kearney has a really nice chapter in the volume where she delves into the details, examining the range of the U.S. social safety net programs that are out there, the purposes for them, where some of them have been successful, where some of them have not been successful, and what it is that they're really attempting to achieve in dealing with problems like growing U.S. inequality. But what the concerns with the current administration approach seems to be is to be less about reforming those programs and providing better incentives to target the underlying issues. And it seems to be much more focused on just cutting them, which could, in a very real sense, exacerbate many of the underlying problems that those programs were intended to address in the first place.
Coming to the tax plan that you just mentioned, it's referred to in the ebook as the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. There's quite a few economists who've actually said that the US tax code needs fixing in the first place. So is there some silver lining to all of this?
It's almost universally agreed amongst economists, amongst policymakers from, you know, all political stripes in the United States, that tax reform is needed. The U.S. tax system is broken. What we have in this volume is a couple of different contributions that examine some elements of the major plans that have been put out there. And really, there's two at this stage that are of critical importance. One is more of a reform proposal. And so this is a reform that's been put out by the House Republican leadership. It's called The Better Way. And it's really a reform in the sense that it proposes to change the U.S. corporate tax system away from the current corporate income tax system to a radically different idea, something called a destination-based cash flow tax. And that's a really reform to the system, whereas President Trump's proposal, from what we know of it so far, is less of a reform, less of a change in the way in which taxes are a collective and incentives are generated, and more of just a basically tax cuts. But one of the more controversial areas of the potential reform proposal is this thing called a border tax adjustment, which is very, very common in countries around the world that have value-added tax schemes, but it's not common to Americans in the United States, where we don't have a value-added tax system. So there's a very nice contribution by a collection of authors in the volume that explains what border tax adjustments are normally, what they're not. You know, they're not import tariffs, they're not trade policy. But then it also examines what some of the potential real unintended consequences would be of moving toward this kind of a tax system on real economic activity, on consumption, on production and exchange rates, trade, and those types of issues as well.
Let's turn now to the second part of the ebook. Trump is the first U.S. president since the Great Recession. What do you think the future would then hold for the Federal Reserve financial regulation put in place since 2008?
That's right. And I think in the United States, there is still a bit of a political hangover after the Great Recession in the mindset of the public, the feeling that despite as well as the U.S. institutions responded in preventing a more dramatic, calamitous set of events from taking place in the United States and not having it echo the 1930s, that nevertheless, the system that we have now in place isn't quite perfect. And so that there is still more to be done. And that includes, you know, candidate Trump and President Trump and other politicians that have threatened the potential independence of the central bank in the United States, the Federal Reserve. So we have a very nice contribution by a couple of authors explaining why it's important to have central bank independence and why it's difficult politically, but the benefits to policymaking when you're able to achieve that and what would likely be of concern and might happen if that were to be taken away or to be put under threat. And as a second contribution, we look at the potential reforms to the financial regulatory environment that was implemented in light of the events of the Great Recession, in particular Dodd-Frank, and the potential reforms that the Trump administration has signaled that it's interested in doing, and a proposal that is coming out of the House of Representatives right now called the Choice Act. So yes, the volume takes up, I think, some of these critical macroeconomic issues confronting financial regulations today in the United States as well.
Turning to the global economy, Trump has been a vocal skeptic of the WTO and free trade in general. What would it actually mean, you write about this in your own essay, if the US were to go from being one of the strongest supporters of free trade to becoming much more protectionist? What would that mean? Is it unprecedented?
In another fantastically important line from his inaugural address, the president has said, protection will lead to great prosperity and strength for the United States. And, you know, that is a statement that is very, very different in a position that is very, very different from U.S. administrations for decades and probably dating back to before the Second World War. And so, you know, I think it is a big open question just how serious this administration is at overhauling the global trading system, the U.S. leadership and role in that system. But they have taken steps already to signal that they're potentially serious about that. So the first thing they did when they came into office was to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the TPP. They have started the process of renegotiating the NAFTA agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But there's also concern that they may seek to actually undermine the broader rules-based trading system that's currently out there that the United States has been a champion of, that's now shepherded by the World Trade Organization, or the WTO. So there's a number of people in high-level cabinet positions in the Trump administration that have publicly stated that they are not happy with the WTO. There are significant misperceptions about basic core benefits of living in a rules-based trading system. And this is my own contribution that we get into with my co-authors, Robert Steger and Alan Sykes, explaining issues like reciprocity and the benefits to the United States of living in a non-discriminatory trading world and abiding by rules like most favored nation treatment. And then potentially what the consequences would be of going back to a 1930s type of trading environment where, you know, those rules and agreements didn't exist.
It sounds like there's a lot of explaining going on. Do you get the sense that you're having to re-explain and re-argue debates that you thought had been won, like, for instance, with regard to independence of the central bank or the benefits of international trade? Do you think there's just a lot of having to repeat the same old things?
I definitely think there is a sense of that. And I think at some level, that's okay. A lot of these core economic, fundamental, underlying, you know, Econ 101 types of arguments for why we have certain institutions in place. We as economists, probably this is our job to explain to the world why it is that we have developed these institutions and the benefits that they provide. You know, we shouldn't necessarily just be able to take them for granted. So I do feel like part of the role of this volume is to try to clarify and to make the case for what some of the benefits of the existing institutional infrastructure are, whether we're talking about central banking, whether we're talking about a rules-based trading system. And so, yes, I do hope that, you know, the president, the administration will look at this book and not necessarily see it as criticism, but as an opportunity to learn from what I think are, you know, a really outstanding group of leading economists explaining what are relatively challenging and not trivial to understand economic and policy issues.
As well as explaining key concepts and going back over old debates, is there some reflection in the ebook?
I do think in the economics profession, we're rethinking how to explain the lessons that we have learned. But I think fundamentally, the way that we do that is we appeal to, you know, three ways of getting across our message. The first is by grounding our analysis in economic theory and to having it be provided as a logically, consistently articulated set of principles and framework, but also recognizing what it is that we can't say from our models and the approach that we as economists take to thinking about economic and policy problems. So the first is theory. The second is wherever we possibly can to back up our analysis and our policy prescriptions with evidence, with our collection of data, with our use of rigorous statistical techniques, where we can do so to try to utilize randomized controlled trials. Some of that obviously is not possible when we're dealing with macroeconomic questions, trade policy questions. It's not possible to randomize necessarily. So there we rely on models. But then third is to really try to appeal as well to the lessons from history. And much of what is being proposed and talked about isn't entirely new, right? There's a lot of lessons to be learned from either the period of the 1980s or even the 1930s, things that we have tried in the past, but that didn't work, explaining clearly why it is that those alternative approaches didn't necessarily work so that we can avoid having to go through episodes like that again, I guess I would say.
In closing then, what do you think, if anything, are the key takeaways from the book?
The key takeaways in terms of economic policy is, to quote President Trump actually, is that it's complicated. There aren't easy solutions to the key pressing policy issues facing the United States and the global economy right now. But what I think we can do is it's a much more fruitful approach is to work together cooperatively in terms of relying on research, relying on evidence, relying on a wide array of voices from across the spectrum and lessons learned from research in these variety of different experiences that different people have had, that different countries have had, trying different approaches to public policy to really have an honest, public, data-intensive, research-intensive debate about the future of U.S. policy. And I think this book hopefully is just the first of many such books and many such pieces of research that are going to delve into these issues that we're going to be facing in the United States.
And you can access the ebook online for free at boxeu.org. Professor Baum, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.